That there may be a correlation between the angle of onset and the BAC, but I think it's so variable that I don't really think it should be used. I mean, the point of the sobriety test is to get enough evidence so you can take someone in and give them a BAC. And I don't really see the point of making an unreliable judgment about the BAC from the behavioral measurement, especially because it's a variable. So I don't recommend that she was, I mean, if I never heard it called the Van Tharp thing, but I recognize that, and it's logical that the wider the angle of your eyes, the more stress the oculomotor system is under, and the more likely the alcohol will produce an effect, so that the more the alcohol, the shorter the angle which will appear. But it appears to me to be too variable to use to make a judgment.
Now, that work was done at SCRI, so how did SCRI get set up?
I did it. I mean, I was running about $1.25 million a year in grants, and I had about 40 people working for me, and the administration at UCLA changed, and I was at that point, I had a joint appointment in the engineering and psychology department, having left the psychiatry department. And we had certain space, and we built some fairly complex driving simulators. I didn't actually build it. There was a group at the engineering department. I was a member of the Institute of Traffic and Transportation Engineering. And I should have mentioned that at Berkeley I got my degree in engineering and physics. So, you know, I managed to fit in. But they had been working for many years at developing driving simulators, and they were very realistic. But they were very insensitive. They had a grant, and they were very insensitive to alcohol. So they hired me to figure out why, which took about 20 minutes, because they were engineers, and they didn't know how. They thought that by making it more and more realistic, it would be more and more sensitive to alcohol, which really had nothing to do with the workload involved in the thing. And being engineers, their concern was primarily on car control. As a matter of fact, I think that led to the problem. Remember when NHTSA spent a lot of money having, I think it was Mercedes-Benz, which had it at some...
In Germany. In
Berlin, they had the world's biggest, best driving simulator. And I said to them, why are you doing it? And they said, well, they've got the best, we'll see the best results. And I said, Mercedes-Benz isn't interested in the environment. They're interested in car control. And they designed this thing to measure different control mechanisms in the car and its control functions. And I said, you're not going to get any results. And they got no results. So there was a similar thing at UCLA, and it didn't take a lot of smarts to be able to talk to them and get that. Anyway, I eventually got a lot of grants from my own, and I had, and I took over the simulator and a variety of things. And I went on for a couple of years, and simulators, big simulators, take up a lot of space. And the university and the engineering decided to build a new engineering building and tear down the old one. And essentially, they didn't want to devote the space that we had been occupying in the new building. See, buildings have a lot to do with careers. And so they said, well, you can take the simulator off campus. I mean, what happened is that there were a lot of projects because they were building and there was no room on the campus, and they rented space at, in Westwood, in the office building. So I said, you mean I should take the simulator and spend God knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars to move it into this office building and pay rent in the office building, and then God knows when something's going to happen, I'm not going to be able to pay the rent. And besides which, you're going to take the same overhead. So the university would charge an overhead, and they would now charge the overhead on the rent I was paying. So I decided that that didn't make sense. So I talked to the two agencies that were supporting me at that time.
Which were who?
NIAAA and NHTSA. And I said, suppose I create an institute, and I created off campus, and can I transfer my grants there?
You didn't tell us how you went from rats to humans, though.
Oh, well, I got diverted with questions.
You got what?
Diverted with questions. But I'll give you the answer to that. I already told Jan, I think, the story. Anyway, when I did the study on brightness discrimination, which was, I built this cage, which was kind of not quite V-shaped. And what happens, you put the rat in at one end, and he looks down to the other end, and there's a wall between that splits it in half after a point, and you've got two compartments. And on the wall there are electroluminescent panels, and below it are bars, and in between, in the middle, there's a dispenser for condensed milk. And what you do is you train the rats so that they start at the back here and they run, and they have to make a decision very soon as to which alleyway they're going to continue to run to a bar to press. And if they run down and press the bar under the brighter of the two lights, they will get milk, and then they're happy. And then you train them that as soon as they get the milk, they run back and they reach past an electronic eye, and it resets the task again, and they turn around and they run back and forth. So they're running back and forth. And this takes a little teaching. And use electroluminescent panels because they have almost instantaneous on and off. You can't use incandescents. I had 10 comparison lights and one standard, and you rotate in a random fashion, which is the brightest. And the important thing from a psychologist's point of view, which makes it a very sensitive test, is that every time they hit the button right, the next light choice is more difficult. Every time they miss, the next light choice is easier. So it's like taking an audiometry test where you've got earphones and they give you a button and they say as long as you can hear the sound, you keep the button pressed. As soon as you can't hear it, you release it. And then as soon as you can hear it again, you press it. And you keep pressing it until you can't hear it. And that test is doing exactly what I was doing with the visual thing. The technique was developed by a guy who got the Nobel Prize for his research and audition named von Bekesi. He was a Hungarian in the United States. And he was a physiological psychologist, more physiologist, and did very brilliant work and developed this technique. And the advantage of it is that instead of in some psychophysical techniques, you run somebody through the panel of comparisons, you're spending a lot of your time not near where the threshold is between seeing the through discrimination ability and not. In this case, you put the rat in, and it's the separation of the lights is at its maximum. And he runs down, presses the bar, the next one's more difficult. Finally, it gets to the point where he's really having trouble.
Yeah, discriminating.
And now he's going to oscillate back and forth over two or three steps, which will be the exact point at which his ability to discriminate. Now, actually, what I found, and I briefly showed the curve, this is a very sensitive measure of brightness discrimination. I don't know why they've never used it in humans. As a matter of fact, but and it certainly could be used in humans. And I had the rats trained, so they did 140 trials in 10 minutes, which meant you could run a lot of rats quick. But you spent a lot of time teaching the rats, and they're very smart, and they'll learn it. So they learned it. And as I point out in my paper, not my paper, my speech, the outline had no effect whatsoever. So I was already thinking to myself, I don't think alcohol is the really prime effects of alcohol are due to its effects on transducer mechanisms, the sensitivity of the transducers, the retina or the ear or the drama or anything, or of your response. We're dealing with essential phenomena. And something happened at the beginning of this study, even before it occurred, which led me to think about it, which was kind of funny. Before the experiment began, I had this instrument placed in what essentially was a coffin with a heavy plywood lid. And I instructed the assistant to, every time he did it, put the animal in to shut the lid and do the experiment, and also to turn off all the lights in the room. And the when he brought me the results of the first series of trials on the rats, this is when we're just training them to run on there, and at the hardest comparison, when the two lights are exactly the same, the rats were getting 62% correct.
We're listening to the click.
What?
They were listening to the click.
That's right. Well, I think. And then, but wait, as the comparison got even easier, their performance got worse. And then it went up and became very easy and high. I went down and I said to the assistant, show me what you had been doing. And he showed me he didn't shut the lid. And I said, why didn't you shut the lid? You know, this is like you'd say to all laboratory assistants, why didn't you do what I tell you to do? Well, it wasn't necessary. The lights are off. Anyway, it was in the old days when we used to build equipment with relays. And somehow or other, those goddamn rats could figure out the difference between the two clicks, depending on which side it was going to be. Now, I couldn't figure out from hearing it. I assume it's that because they couldn't have seen it where the relay panel was, even with the thing open. But the interesting thing is, you say, why didn't they do better from that point? Why is it that they got worse? And I think it was because then they had two conflicting sources of information, and they got confused. I'll call it confused. I guess I don't know a good. You could say it was mental overload. So I deduced from that that rats were a hell of a lot smarter than assistants. That was one conclusion. Rats were not mechanical devices, that they were animals with cognition. And there was obviously something going on. And that sounded more interesting. And at the same time, I came to the conclusion that alcohol was more likely to be affected cognition than any of the other periphery thing. And once I decided to deal with cognition, I decided it was very hard to... It was much harder to devise experiments with animals to tease out some of the variables on the cognitive factors than it was to go to humans.
Okay, but there's a huge jump from rats to humans.
Not so big.
Cost?
Oh, yes.
Ethical concerns?
Yes.
Ability to get things done quickly?
Yes.
What's your problem,
man? I mean, you know, that's life. once you have to pick... My son got his doctoral dissertation working on C. elegans. You know what C. elegans?
Yes, of course.
Yes. He's a developmental geneticist.
They show up for every research appointment and don't go home and quit.
Right. But when he decided to work on cardiac function, he went to the mouse. You have to go to a model that's appropriate to the problem you want to deal with.
But tell me the implications of that as far as funding, as far as time, as far as productivity.
Well, you certainly need a hell of a lot more money if you're doing humans than if you do animals. And you certainly can run a hell of a lot more animals fast. Depends what you're doing. I knew a guy who was doing staining of individual cells. What was that technique they used to use? Silver staining?
Yeah, silver staining.
Yes, and he went to Italy for 2 years to learn how to do silver staining and came back, and the technique was so difficult and bitchy. But it showed all the axons and all the... Yeah. And then a couple of years later, you know, you could get around doing it. There were better techniques. But, you know, you go with it. So even with animals, you go where the technique, where the problem, either you leave the problem or you go where the problem can go. I left animal research, behavioral animal research on alcohol because I thought that I wasn't going to get easily to where I thought the answer was. And I can say honestly that in the ensuing 45 years that transpired after that, I don't think I've read anything in the literature where somebody came up with an animal model and showed me that he solved that problem. And of studying cognition in rats and solved it with alcohol.
Well, can we go back to talking about SCRI and talk about some of the development of the work you did with NHTSA and how you came to work with Marcy Burns?
Would you like to take a short break?
Yeah, well, yeah, and let me finish this...
I'm going on. I'm not starting at 8 tomorrow. I'm going to run. Because I can't be thinking for 8 o'clock if I'm going to bed at 11.
But you don't go with this. Barry.
No. Historical. This is so, Herb, this is so interesting because you've gone through all this historical time and all these evolutions and research. Very important to document.
Well, we can. Yes, but Barry, I wouldn't have talked about ICATS and that stuff, as frankly, if I had known you were recording it. So I don't know what you're going to do with this, but I don't want that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't mind talking about my history, but.
We're going to put this on the ICATS website.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you too for 2 weeks.
Hey, this is really key.
I'll get a letter from Dabowski tomorrow.
Herb, this is so important, though. The continual battle between animal models and humans and the costs and the risks and everything is really important.
Well, having been trained as a basic scientist, and working with animal models and believing in the theory of evolution and believing that animals are our progenitors, I'm a great believer in doing animal research. If you can create the model that you need to do the research in animals. And I can't imagine, I mean, I was able fairly rapidly to figure out the issue of division of attention and information processing, adapting techniques that were already being used with humans. And as I said to you, here it is 45 years later, and I'm unaware of anybody who's developed animal models of that kind of cognitive function.
When you started your work in humans, there were also, I think, many research in the field of human performance who were actually focused on vigilance, like Quirce and McKay and
Schumann. The big emphasis was on...
Were they kind of starting also the drugs and driving? And had they a focus on drugs and driving at all?
No, I don't... Well, they applied it. But the emphasis was on vigilance, and I felt that was the wrong emphasis. That, you know, that's a vigilance effect, but I didn't think that was the prime. I mean, you know, if a guy's falling asleep, you've got a vigilance problem, and I think that's one of the problems with alcohol. But I think there's another problem. And that's why in that experiment I showed you with the peripheral vision, you know, you can call it a vigilance test for detecting the lights in the periphery, and they're in for almost 30 minutes at each level of the experiment. And there's no effect. I called it concentrated attention. And the reason I called it concentrated attention is because there's apparently some tasks people with alcohol can perform and continue to perform continually, even at fairly decent levels of alcohol over a long period of time. Now there occurs a vigilance effect, and I've never really worked at trying to separate out what the conditions are where you would get the kind of decrement that you get with in vigilance, but you don't get it with concentrated attention. They're on the face of it, definitionally, they both seem to be the same. But so there's some other variable going on, some other phenomenon. But I looked at that, and I looked at vigilance effects, and I didn't feel that that was the major cause of the problem.
And in your research on alcohol, did you come across any pitfalls that you think we are sort of reliving now in our drug research? I mean, issues that are sort of coming back?
Well, my emphasis, which I didn't finish, my original plan with alcohol and then with marijuana was to develop a behavioral typology in which I would be able to describe the drug over at least a dozen different dimensions, so that most of the parameters that would be involved in performance would be covered, and that I would then go on to another drug and do the same extensive variety. I mean, you know, I must have done 70, 80 or more experiments with alcohol, and to try to define its behavioral impairment nature, its performance effect. I haven't worked on affect. As I told you, my early work with the animals made me suspicious. In fact, one of the reasons I was happy to do the brightness study in rats is rats don't have attitudes. And you don't get subjective effects from what they anticipate. You all have heard apocryphal stories about somebody coming to a party and saying, what's in the punch? And they say, oh, it's loaded with alcohol, and they haven't put the alcohol in, they take a drink and they flop down drunk, you know. It's clear that there's a suggestive effect. In fact, think of the people in the movies who got to be thirsty. They weren't in the desert, but they were influenced by what they saw, and that led them to become thirsty, and it can lead to other behaviors. So you can have that effect, but people offer this explanatory that alcohol has a particular effect on negative reinforcers, and you're drinking because you're trying to mitigate the negative effect. And insofar as I could touch it with an animal model, I got nothing. So, but there are things, that, I mean, I started some work on sleep. I would say that the effect of alcohol on sleep and circadian rhythms, and you have to look at all three variables at once, because there are at least a dozen studies now showing major effects of alcohol and sleep, but they're variable, and the variable is they don't really control for circadian effects. So you have an interaction between the fact that the guy's out driving after midnight and he's sleep deprived, and it's also not as normal sleep. So nobody has really adequately examined that. And I was interested. I started with a group of people at Henry Ford Hospital, sleep specialists, but then it was too distant, the relationship. It didn't work out. So there are other variables. There seems to be a lot of apocryphal evidence and experimental evidence that alcohol improves aggression. You know, when you wonder what role that plays in driving. There are other variables that are important. I've concentrated on the one that I thought was the most important from driving, based on my analysis of accident records. And I would say, based on the latest work on the 100-car naturalistic study, the role of sleep has been underestimated, and therefore, and incidentally, in their study, they didn't control for the alcohol. Because, and you know about the 100-car NHTSA?
I don't.
Oh, well, that's a very important study. NHTSA equipped 100 cars with recording devices and cameras focused on the driver, focused on the street, and around them. I think there were about 8 cameras. And they gave them free leases to people. They accumulated, I don't know, about 1,000 people. And the people didn't know it, but every once in a while, some of them got in an accident. And 20% of the cases of them getting in an accident, their eyes were closed. They were nodding off. I mean, nobody anticipated this result. I mean, we're still in a very early stage with the quality of research on accident causation. So I think that's very important, because obviously this happened. There was nobody who rushed there with a breathalyzer to determine how many of these people were under alcohol. But given what's known already about the effects of alcohol, and that would be an important area of research. And if it was still screwing around, I would probably want to do some of that and other things. But the point that I make or was making, is that my conception of the way to advance the science is to take a drug and to make sure you develop an adequate behavioral description of the drug effect. So that, I mean, what happens is somebody goes and they study the ophthalmologist, they study effects of alcohol on eye movements or something. And so you get a report, and they'll go out and say,
I think melted ice cream.
Oh, is that what? Oh, was that my ice cream?
We need to probably start wrapping things up. So do you have some final thoughts about where this field is headed, Herb?
Perdition. I don't know where it's headed. I mean, you're a much younger generation, and I'm hoping that you're going to carry it forward. But I started with marijuana and kind of gave it up.
Why? Why did you give it up?
Well, because, let me get rid of it. Part of it gets into the politics of what happens between agencies and within agencies, and I'd rather leave some of that off the tech. So it's a matter of, unfortunately, the nature of the funding. It's not like 100 years ago, you know, you're a professor and you picked the field and you did what you wanted with your field and so forth. Today, research is highly driven by the demands of the agencies, and a lot of researchers say, I'll give you arpeggio when they're really going to work on something else. They'll sell you what they think you want while they're trying to do something else that's only partially successful. So part of it has to do with the nature of the agency. NHTSA, in my estimation, I'll say this on the tape, has been badly served by the fact that it's primarily a contract agency. And so the masterminds in the offices in Washington determine what the head of the agency wants for the campaign for the next year, and that's what they give you money for. And NIH in general has avoided that, even though not wholly, and I think NIH, NIAAA and NIDA have been among the worst in that group. Instead of picking researchers who are doing good research and letting them follow where they want to go, as long as they have something productive that they think they're going at. But I think the whole profession it wastes a lot of time and direction because it set the direction of the bureaucrats in Washington who think that as research administrators they really have greater insight into what the problems are and how to approach them. You can publicize that.
It's a good sign by it.
No, I think well, it's a thanks. Great sign by yeah.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that with us, sir. And,
you're welcome. So, edit out anything right. to do oh, with the...
We appreciate all your insight.
Or at least anecdotes.
Great anecdotes.
Okay.
We'll thank all you. Trot home.
Yeah. Wonderful dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
great dinner.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
you're
you.
Cutting it out.
Yes.
But you're welcome to carry on. We're welcome to carry on the conversation back at the hotel.
How's that?
Miles
who's walking back?
Everybody,
I guess. I have the car keys.